My apologies. Thank you.
No worries. All right, so let's call the meeting to order. It is 8:08 a.m. on March 11, 2024, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. The meeting is being held virtually using Zoom. The public have been properly notified of the options to attend and observe the meeting. Roll call, Ms. Po.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino? Dr. Davey? Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Mr. Wynn? We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So regarding remarks and announcements, please keep in mind that any times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to the former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you very much for all of the time that you spend in preparing for these meetings. And I'll also thank you for continuing to use the raise hand feature because it really helps sort of keep the meeting organized and facilitates the chair in recognizing when you wish to speak. Regarding the board survey, the board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I want to recognize, the many, many hours that board staff and board members spend in preparing for this meeting. And it's a slightly unusual meeting because we are used to Friday meetings, but it's a Monday meeting. So I also want to thank all of the workplaces of the board members who have been gracious in loaning you all to us for today's meeting. And I want to thank our board staff for the many hours they spend in getting all of the board members prepared. Thank you very much. Regarding continuing education, the attendance at board meetings is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. Should its duration be 4 hours or more, please make a note of the code words provided throughout the meeting. To report the code words to board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meetings page for this particular meeting. It is unlikely that this meeting will be 4 hours in duration. It seems like a fairly short agenda. So thank you for your consideration. Call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Under ARS 38-431.02 subsection H, the board may only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. If you wish to speak, please unmute your line at this time, state your name, and I'll call on you. Hearing none, let's go to number five, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates for the board?
I do not at this time, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Consent agenda number six. Are there any recusals from any items on the consent agenda? Hearing none, does any board member wish to pull an item or remove an item from the agenda for independent discussion and action? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
So moved.
Thank you. I'll give it to Dr. Stanhoff and second by Dr. Medina. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. So let's go to number seven, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed supervised practice plan for Ann Eberhardt PsyD. So on this, Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Eberhardt is currently complying with the terms of a consent agreement. Essentially, this agreement establishes two broad sets of requirements, one of which really constitutes a monitoring program. And since the execution of that consent agreement in November of 2023, she has been demonstrating as such that she is complying with those terms, reporting requirements are being met, and so forth. And then the other component of this agreement is that she will not be issued her psychologist license until such time that she establishes that she is under the supervision of a licensed psychologist who will oversee her practice. So she and I have had at least two conversations that I can recall since November, during which she posed questions to me relative to, you know, what that supervision plan or what the supervision agreement might look like, what might it, what must it require, and so forth. And a lot of those questions I didn't have answers to or didn't have clarity. So they sort of raised, you know, different possibilities or variations or scenarios. And so my recommendation to her was to try to identify someone who has had experience supervising trainees, such as postdoc program participants, and to create a training plan, a supervision plan that closely emulates the requirements of the postdoc supervision plan as outlined in board rule. And so what Dr. Eberhardt has done is she has identified a proposed supervisor, Dr. Fred Higgins, and he has supplied the board with a plan. And then also with his credentials and his background information to consider for possible board approval. Should the board approve him as the supervisor, then staff would complete the process of activating the license, and she would then immediately be subject to the terms of this plan. I encourage them both to be present today to address any questions, provide any clarification the board might have. And I believe they are both here today. I do see them. Great. Thank you. And just by way of clarification, the agreement does say that the supervision plan can be approved by the executive director. I just think with all of the questions and uncertainty around, you know, the different possibilities and what the plan may have reflected made me uncomfortable with that responsibility. And so it was very much, you know, my recommendation to bring everything before the board for the assurance that this could be approved. What I was, of course, trying to circumvent was a situation where at the conclusion of the supervisory period, the board were to find at that time that, you know, the plan or the supervision or some component thereof was deficient. And so with that, I can answer any questions before I think we give Drs. Eberhardt and Wiggins an opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. Any questions for Ms. Pakkinen at this time? Hearing none, I see Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins, you're present. Thank you for being here. So at this time, do members of the board have any questions for Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins? And then, you know, maybe we'll see if they wish to make a statement as well. So I have a few questions. So Dr. Eberhardt, thank you for being proactive and, getting together with Dr. Wiggins and preparing a plan. I know this has been many months in the making, so I commend you for all of the efforts and for all of the communication that you maintained with our board staff on this. My question relates to sort of the 12-month supervisory period. I know there has been some discussion about the supervision needs to occur for 12 months and not just, sort of the agreement has to be in effect for 12 months, if you understand what I'm saying. So the agreement, I believe, was so the agreement between the board and Dr. Eberhardt was entered into in August or November, I think, November of 2023. And in February of 2024, the agreement between Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins was entered. So my question relates to, the 12-month period of supervision starts when the actual sort of actual supervision. It's not just a 12-month, period under the agreement. So I just want clarification on that. And either our staff can speak to that or Dr. Eberhardt, if you want to speak to it.
Well, I'll just say what my understanding is, and then maybe I can be corrected if I'm wrong. But what I understand is the monitoring period started in November and will end next year. That's that time. But the supervision period would start when the board approved the training plan and would go for a year from that point. So that there's two different kind of trajectories.
Thank you for that clarification. And board staff, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, that is the understanding that I have been maintaining. I think it's important for Ms. Galvin to also weigh in here, but I think it's important that we're having this conversation so that everyone has the same understanding. But Ms. Galvin, let's pose the question to her.
And good morning. Good morning, Dr. Eberhardt. Good morning, Dr. Wiggins. Nice to see you again. The interpretation should be that the supervision occurs for 12 months. So you can enter into the supervision plan, but until such time that there are psychological activities to supervise, we have to have 12 months of actual practice supervision.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. And then my next question is maybe to Dr. Wiggins and to our professional members on the board. I'm looking at page 15 of our packet of the PDF. There is a 12-month training plan to meet the requirements of the board consent agreement. So it's in relation to that. Dr. Wiggins, could you speak to what sort of thought process you went through and what sort of collaboration you went through with Dr. Eberhardt in coming up with this plan and how, like, explain to the board, how this plan, in your view, would help Dr. Eberhardt in the practice.
Absolutely. And thank you for the question. And there was quite a process of discussion and getting some clarification of exactly what was needed, what Dr. Eberhardt was seeking, and even in determining whether or not I would be the best person to provide that for her. Dr. Eberhardt was forthcoming and clear about her previous postdoc experience and some of the struggles that and challenges that she had encountered there. Particularly, what she did was provide me with feedback that she had received from that postdoc experience in terms of where some of those challenges were. I used that. I looked at benchmarks that are to be expected to be accomplished by postdocs, according to APA, and had conversation with her about her own desires for professional growth and development. And based on that, we looked at the process of what that 12-month supervision would look like in order to accommodate all of those things. And so we collaborated around the, again, the specifics that she wanted and the things that I think also would be important to be able to accomplish. And both in terms of having some didactic experience along with the actual clinical experience. And so that was the foundation from which the supervision or the training program was established. And essentially what you have before you is the result of that.
Thank you, Dr. Wiggins. Let me see if any of the board members have questions for Dr. Eberhardt or Dr. Wiggins. Yes, Dr. Stewart, and then Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Dr. Wiggins, good morning. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Are you comfortable with the agreement, with the supervision agreement as proposed and written and signed by yourself and Dr. Eberhardt?
Yes.
Okay. Does it meet with your expectations? Does it cover all the areas that you would like to cover with her?
Yes, it does. And honestly, I'm hoping that if we discover that there's something else that are adjustments that need to be made, we'll make those as we go along. This is a firm guide for us, but I don't want it to be so rigid that we can't amend or again make adjustments for things that we might discover would be beneficial to add as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. Dr. Eberhardt, thank you for being here as well. I know this has been a long, arduous process for you. Are you comfortable with the agreement and specifically with Dr. Wiggins' comment that if something does come up, if he sees something that's not covered in the supervision agreement, that it can be changed to accommodate that? Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I have every confidence in Dr. Wiggins' judgment. So I'm very
happy. Yeah, so do I. Thank you, Mr. Dinar. That's all of my questions for right now.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Dinar. And thank you for being here today, Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins. Excellent pairing, by the way. Kudos to you both. I was wondering, I was looking at the training plan, and I was wondering if you both considered having a self-care plan included in the training plan and having some identified activities for Dr. Eberhardt to consider undertaking during the time of the supervision process.
Well, you know, I'll speak to that first. We didn't specifically identify a self-care plan. I do know that Dr. Eberhardt is engaged in the process of directly engaging some self-care. Part of my approach to supervision kind of has that as a underlying element as we explore and examine what the process is that the supervisee is going through. So in my own perspective, that's included. But that's a good idea. I certainly would consider giving some thought to a concrete and identifiable self-care activities.
I think that might be helpful for you both just to have clear deliverables, if you will, around the self-care plan.
Good point.
Any further questions? Yes, Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins. Thank you for being here. I do have a question in regards to, you know, I know, for example, as a postdoctoral supervisor, right? The supervisor holds the ultimate sort of responsibility for the clients and the treatment that they receive. And I'm wondering who is going to be that person. So are you going to be Dr. Wiggins or is it Dr. Eberhardt?
Clarify for me a little bit. I want to make sure I understand what you're asking.
Yes. So as a postdoctoral, if I'm a supervisor, whether it's for a
postdoctoral fellow resident or for an intern. Ultimately, the clinical responsibility for the treatment of the patient that my supervisee is treating lies on the supervisor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so now this appears, and you thank you for that question, because it might provide some clarification. As I understand the consent agreement, that Dr. Eberhardt will be licensed as a psychologist, but she will have her practice monitored. And so as a licensed psychologist, she will have responsibility for her clinical work.
Okay.
And that's my understanding.
Okay. And so that's the difference.
Right.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Well, I'm making sure that we're on the same page with that as well.
No, I fully agree. And that's what I am asking, because I supervise, or, you know, I'm in contact with lots of supervisors, and I know that's a difference. So I think this is a different sort of case, yes, right? Circumstance. And I just want a clarification on that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. And I think, I mean, to your question, I remember seeing somewhere either in the consent agreement or in the supervision agreement that spells out what was just stated to us as well.
Well, yes, in page 14 there is, but I want a clarification on that, because that is, it's a marked difference from like supervision. It, although, you know, this is defined a little bit different. That's where, so I just want a clarification on that.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Any further questions? So I think at this time, let's go into our discussion portion of this agenda item. So I believe the matter is in front of the board for approval of the supervision agreement, correct, Ms. Pakkanen? Okay, then maybe discussion around that or a motion. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I can have a brief discussion and also make a motion at the same time if you wish. Certainly after it. Listening to Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins this morning with the clarifications that Ms. Hakkinen have provided, and the responses that Dr. Wiggins has provided for the board questions, I'm very comfortable with this. I like the idea that it's a living document, that if something comes up, an issue, that things can be changed to accommodate that. And so based upon that, I would move that the board approve the supervision agreement for Dr. Eberhardt with Dr. Wiggins.
Dr. Stanhoff?
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Stewart. It seems like it's laid out in a good fashion. Plus, I to Dr. Stewart's comment on, it's a living document, and the fact that it is dynamic and the way that we can, or that they can change it as needed, I think is ideal. So I'd second Dr. Stewart's motion.
Thank you, Dr. Stanhoff. So there's a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Eberhardt and Dr. Wiggins, for bringing this plan to us, and good luck in your future endeavors with the supervision plan.
Pursuant to the terms of the consent agreement, Mr. Chairman, the license will issue as soon as the staff is able to accomplish that.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. All right, then let's go to number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the results of the evaluation completed by Brett Ringdahl, PhD, in accordance with his interim consent agreement, an order for evaluation and practice restrictions for complaint number 24-17. And on this, Ms. Michelson, will you please provide the board with a status update?
Yes, Mr. Chair. At its December meeting, the board approved an interim consent agreement for a pending complaint against Dr. Ringdill, which contained the following terms. During the pendency of the interim agreement, his license to practice psychology is suspended. Because it is not a final decision by the board regarding the pending investigation, it is subject to further consideration. The suspension of that license shall continue until such time the board enters a final order. And additionally, prior to the lifting of suspension, he is required to complete a comprehensive eval within 120 days with a pre-approved evaluator that includes a substance use component and to assess whether he has any substance use issues. Dr. Ringdale did complete the required evaluation back in January that was completed within the required timeframe. The evaluator's report was very recently received, which is included in the board's packet. I will not discuss the specifics of the evaluation in open session, but the evaluator did make various recommendations relative to treatment and various practice restrictions. Dr. Ringdale was supplied a copy of that report and response was requested. That letter is in your packet as well. He did indicate his willingness to enter into a consent agreement with the terms outlined in the evaluator's report. However, I noted that he did request the board consider modifying the timeframe for the practice restriction. I do see that Dr. Ringdale is present, so he can present his modification request to the board and explain his reasoning for that. So the board may elect to consider offering Dr. Ringdale a consent agreement, the terms of which may encompass the evaluator's recommendations and any other terms or conditions that the board believe is warranted to protect the public. So this concludes my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Any questions from Ms. Michelson at this time? Hearing none, let's go to Dr. Ringdale. I see you in the list of participants, so if you want to unmute yourself and maybe if you have the option of getting on video, get on video, and then you may make a brief statement to the board or await the board's questions.
Hello, good morning. I'm sorry I can't start my video right now. I appreciate the consideration. In my written response, my only adjustment concerning the date was instead of the restriction being an additional 12 months practice restriction, the recommendation from the evaluator was at least 12 months of practice restriction, which would put us to approximately November 10th. That was the only consideration that I would ask of the board. And then at that time, proceeding with the supervised temporary licensure plan, if the board sees fit after reevaluation or whatever the requirement would be at that time. And that's the only other than that, I'm completely willing and responsible for whatever else the board would suggest of me. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ringdale, and thank you again for being here. Let's see if the board members have any questions for you. And if there are any questions regarding personal health information, we can go into executive session. So, Dr. Ringdale, I have a question or two depending on... So I'm looking at the recommendations in the report, and I see that there is, you know, it sort of talks about at least 6 and up to 12 months. And I just want to make sure that, you know, from the board's perspective, we just want to assure ourselves that, you know, any period that we mention in the consent agreement that we offer, helps protect the public and helps you in your practice and helps you sort of get from point A to point B where we need to be, you know, after the conclusion of that period. So could you tell me your sort of thinking in terms of a less than 12 month period? So I mean, in essence, you're asking us to go against the recommendation offered. And, you know, we could, based on the recommendation, go up to the maximum recommended period, which is 12 months. So I just wanted your thoughts on, in your view, what are some of the factors that that would lead the board, that would give the board assurances that a less than 12 month period would be appropriate?
So the first recommendation is regarding suspension of licensure for a period of at least 12 months. That 12 months, my license has been suspended since November 10th of 2023. And I'm agreeing that, for further suspension until, November 10th of 2024. And then at that time, pending the board's, consideration of temporary licensure at that point, then, 6 to 12 months, whatever the board sees fit. If that makes sense. So two separate periods following the recommendations of Dr. Lazarus in that report. I hope that was clear.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. So you described the terms of the agreement. I was looking more to, you know, if what in your view would make us, that second period that we're looking at, what in your view would make us offer a consent agreement that would be less than 12 months duration at that time?
I don't have a great answer for that right now. I mean, her recommendation was 6 to 12 months. If the board sees that 12 months is what the recommendation is, and I'm willing to abide by that.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ringdale. Any more questions? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Patty. It looks like that do I understand this correctly, that the board, Ms. Harkonnen, can bring this matter back before the board anytime within the 6 to 12 months? So if there's a change that is warranted, that it can be looked at, Dr. Ringdahl's functioning during that time, and so the board can at that point reduce the time to the 6 months as recommended, between that range of 6 to 12 months. So all it has to do, it doesn't have to be fixed now, does it? I mean, we can bring it back before the board, and the board can decide to lessen the time of that 6 to 12 months.
Ms. Gavin?
Thank you. I believe what Dr. Rendall is seeking, the evaluator suggested a 12-month suspension. He is saying, I have been suspended since November. Basically, can he have time-served suspension? So the suspension would be from November of 23 to November of 24, even though we may not sign the agreement until March of 24, he would get credit for the suspension that he's already served.
And if I may clarify just that about the suspension date, his license was not suspended until December 8th when the board approved the interim consent agreement. So it was not November when the complaint was received. It was not until the board approved that agreement, just to clarify. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's helpful clarification. So we're looking at 12 months from December 8th as the potential suspension period. Dr. Medina.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted clarification on that. It sounded to me like what Ms. Gavin was saying. He wanted credit for the time served already because he has already been suspended since December, like Ms. Michelson specified, clarified.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further questions for Dr. Ringdale at this time? So let's go into discussion. I think there's consensus on what needs to happen. The 12 month, as a matter of discussion, again, I'll entertain a motion, but 12 month suspension from December 8th And then after that period of suspension, according to the terms of the, according to the recommendations of the evaluation, up to 12 months of supervision, and Dr. Ringdale can come back and ask the board for lifting that supervision period, depending on changed circumstances and any future developments that might occur. So that's sort of what I'm thinking about. But again, please let's have a discussion. Dr. Seidman.
Yes, thank you. So I believe what we're saying then is a minimum of 6 months supervision, and then looking at the progress made, and then the board could stop that supervision, if you will, prior to that full 12-month period, depending on the progress being made.
Dr. Stewart. You're muted, Dr. Stewart.
I knew I'd do that at least once. yeah, I agree with Dr. Seidman that, you know, this seems pretty well laid out, that he can, the licensee can come back before the board after 6 months, and then the board can reconsider the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And then that actually raises a question. So I think the license is up for renewal in July of 2024, if I'm not mistaken. So it might have to come up for renewal, or maybe Ms. Galvin has the answer to that.
There's typically provision included in the consent agreement that if he doesn't renew his license, sometimes it can be, you know, reverted to an automatic suspension, or the compliance terms are told until he does renew. But that is something that we can discuss with Dr. Ringdahl at that time, whether, you know, he intends to renew. But the consent agreement typically provides for that situation. With respect to the supervision, typically the consent agreement could be drafted to say that he is under practice supervision for a minimum period of 12 months, but it would allow him to come back to the board at 6 months to have that term lifted or renegotiated. I would recommend it being drafted that way rather than a six-month supervision, and then if things weren't you know, approved by the board, we would have to add another, you know, period of supervision. So if the supervision could be for a minimum period of 12 months, but then give him the option to come back at six to have that lifted or modified in some way.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Galvin. And that actually closes like a potential loophole. I know you would come up with a wise solution. The loophole being, you know, the 6 month supervision period ends, and then he comes back, and then there is a gap in supervision. And then maybe if the board at that point feels that additional 6 months is needed, then there's that gap. So thank you, Ms. Galvin. So any further discussion or motion? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I. If you entertain a motion, I move that the board approve the agreement as notated, including the notations from Ms. Galvin.
Second.
There's a second by Dr. Medina. Any further discussion? And I think this is a roll call.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Pope, please do a roll call.
Chairman, Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. And thank you, Dr. Ringdale, for being here. So let's now, actually, let's come back to number 9. Let's go to number 10, if that's okay, Ms. Pakkanen.
And, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So this is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the following recommendations from the Committee on Behavior Analysts. So there are three matters under this agenda item, and we'll address them one by one. Ms. Pakkanen, will you please begin with the first one to include an overview of the case and the adjudication recommendation of the CBA committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So specific to my summary, specific to 10A, the Committee on Behavior Analysts, during its most recent meeting, reviewed this complaint. In doing so, the respondent participated in this proceeding, as did a witness who was very provided a lot of information, you know, to help inform the committee's recommendations. Acknowledging that the committee had what it considered to be a less than complete set of records that really that fully informed, you know, the committee's analysis and evaluation of the matter. What ultimately the committee decided to accept is, you know, the consistent testimony of the respondent as well as the witness being her former supervisor, that the supervision that was supplied to Ms. Johnson, to the respondent, for the time where she was providing services but not yet licensed in Arizona, adequate supervision or appropriate supervision was supplied to her. And so the committee, again, based on, you know, the information they did have, were able to forward a recommendation to this board to dismiss the complaint. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that piece.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Any questions for Ms. Pakkanen at this time? Hearing none, I see Ms. Johnson. Are you present?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. So, I'm Mandy Carvis. I'm counsel for Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis, and thank you for being here. Good morning. So maybe, you know, please introduce yourselves for the record, and then you may make a statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions.
Sure. Mandy Carvis of Wicker Smith on behalf of and with my client, Ms. Johnson, who will also introduce herself.
I'm Dana Johnson, and I just wanted to say that I understand that licensing is my responsibility, and I learned through this process that I rely too heavily upon my employer to know those requirements for me. And now I understand that it's solely my responsibility and that I should have got on the BACB website and been familiar with those specifically and not relied so solely on my employer. Thank you.
And members of the board, the only thing I would add is Ms. Johnson has been before this board in a companion case with this before and has expressed to the board her now understanding, as she just did again, that her scope of practice is within her sole responsibility, regardless of what an employer tells her. She's learned a lot from this situation. She completed required continuing education associated with the companion complaint. She's cooperated with everything that this board has asked of her throughout the investigation of both complaints. And we are fully supportive, obviously, of the committee's recommendation to dismiss this complaint against Ms. Johnson. But again, if any members of the board have any questions regarding this matter or what led to this, Ms. Johnson or myself are happy to address them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis. Any questions for Ms. Johnson or Ms. Carvis at this time? Hearing none, let's go into discussion. Anything the board members would like to discuss? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Yeah, it seems pretty well explained by the licensee, the applicant, as well as the attorney, Ms. Carvis. And I'm pretty happy with the explanation, and I don't see any problems with going ahead and dismissing this complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Dr. Stewart. She's taking care of what needs to be taken care of. It was unfortunate. I'm hoping that Ms. Johnson, due to this experience and her continued work as a behavior analyst in the state, will help inform future behavior analysts that are coming through who may not be licensed yet, and guide them on the whole process and the need to be licensed and work practice in the state. So I appreciate the the repeated visits, but also the fact that you have Ms. Johnson is taking care of it. So I'm going to second Dr. Stewart's motion.
All right, so we'll retroactively consider Dr. Stewart to have made a motion and then Dr. Stenhoff to have made the second.
Dr. Stewart, I apologize. I thought there was a motion somewhere.
I like the way you think, Dr. Steinhoff.
Mr. Chair, my apologies, but thank you for retroactively attributing that to Dr. Stewart.
And
no worries.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly put that as a motion.
All right. Thank you for that confirmation. Let's see if there is any other discussion around the motion. All right, hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jarvis. Thank you,
Ms. Johnson. Have a nice day, everyone.
So let's go to 10B. So this is the board. This is the matter for supplementing its previous referrals of Centria Healthcare to various regulatory, law enforcement, and payer entities with information gained during its investigation of complaint number 24-12. Ms. Packenet, will you please summarize this matter to include the committee's recommendation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this is the second of the three recommendations that the committee has forwarded to the board. So what I think the record establishes is that there were efforts made on our part in order to fully investigate Ms. Johnson's, how she functioned, how her services were represented, and whether she therefore practiced as a behavior analyst while unlicensed for that period of about 2 months. We did make what would be a not unusual effort to try to obtain all the available records to fully inform both the committee and the board. But your investigative report reflects that the subpoenas that were issued, we received partial records in response to those, and also communication citing the company's position relative to why other records would not be supplied. And as really where that left the committee was not having the full picture in terms of how Ms. Johnson's services were reflected with respect to the payers involved. And so that compelled the committee to forward a recommendation to, and this is a little nuanced, but there has been, as of September of 2023, a referral of Centria to a series of other investigative bodies in terms of, you know, this is information we are forwarding to you. We leave it to you to ascertain whether there is any compelling reason to investigate on your part because the board doesn't have jurisdiction to do so. So the nuance is the committee's recommendation really reflects that this would potentially be new information to augment or supplement what has already been provided to the Arizona Attorney General, the Access Office of Inspector General, Arizona Department of Health Services, the accrediting organization called Behavioral Health Center of Excellence, And I think the Joint Commission, I think we've been notified by that group that Centria is not accredited there. So I will confirm that because I don't remember that detail. At any rate, that is the recommendation of the committee. Are there any questions about that specific recommendation? I do want to acknowledge, you know, in the process that we did receive very recently communication from that company's counsel, Flynn Carey. He is present today, and I anticipate that he will ask the board for permission to speak on behalf of his client. But I'm happy to answer questions in the meantime.
Thank you, Ms. Paikkanen. Any questions for Ms. Paikkanen at this time? Hearing none, I see Mr. Carey. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm sure you want to make a statement, and then we'll have questions for you.
With your permission, Chair Dinar, I would like to address the board.
Sure.
So our concern here, and you will hear some of these concerns echoed in item number three or item number C related to item 10. The board has vehicles by which to investigate. It opted to utilize a subpoena that it did not perfect. The board has the ability to engage in enforcement. It has the ability to domesticate. What the board, you're as a board, you're an Arizona agency, and so your jurisdiction ends at the Arizona border. And so items were sent to a company that is outside of Arizona. And this is not a case where what Centria did is simply ignore the subpoenas, even though lawfully they could do that. Behind the scenes, and I think hopefully these have been communicated to you, we have provided letter upon letter to the board providing materials, even when there was no jurisdiction to compel us to do so. We attempted to work with the board. In my experience in civil litigation, when a party objects to a subpoena, especially a subpoena for which there's no jurisdiction, the next step is generally what's called a meet and confer between the parties. And what we received instead were a series of subpoenas to which we responded to the extent that we were comfortable responding, all happening on the backdrop of being reported and apparently going to be reported another time to agencies. So Centria has done a significant amount to be a good steward here. We have provided a significant amount of information, and clearly it was enough information for the board or the BA to feel comfortable dismissing against Ms. Johnson. So my position would remain that you had the information that you needed to properly look at that case. When I approached the board a few months ago to attempt to help the communication, we did not simply cut off communication and not respond to these subpoenas. They were responded to, material was provided, and now that material, again, is going to be used for a referral. So I think it sends a really problematic message to companies and if this is the process, because the board is essentially taking a position here that we're going to send a unperfected, non-domesticated, non-enforced subpoena. And when you assert your legal rights, our next step is we're going to start sending you out to law enforcement agencies. And I think that the board needs to consider, first, it's already made the referral. So all it is doing now is gilding the lily. It's adding more information unnecessarily when not allowing these other agencies to do what they need to do if they really believe there's a violation. But also, I think you're setting a precedent here, which is very dangerous, which is even though we don't have jurisdiction over you companies, if you don't play ball, we're going to make things very difficult for you. And that's the takeaway that I think you have to be very careful about. We certainly could just have ignored. And I'm not saying that as gamesmanship, I'm not saying that to be difficult. Legally, we could have ignored your subpoenas and we didn't do that. And so what I would ask is you reject the idea that the board needs to be essentially deputized for all these other agencies and sending more information over. If there's an investigation that needs to happen with those agencies, allow those investigations to occur. But the board, as I believe Ms. Galvin noted in her comments in front of BA, you investigate and you regulate licensees. You don't represent, you don't litigate company, or you don't investigate or do anything involving companies. And so I think this is a pretty significant overstep. And so our request would be that you deny the BA committee's request, allow the referrals that have already been made to proceed, and move on.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. So I have a question regarding Sentry. I know you present sort of an interesting personal jurisdiction question that is perhaps worthy of a law school exam, but Centria is probably required to be registered or have a registered person in Arizona to receive any SURF documents. So help me understand that.
The position is it's a company out of state. No one sent anything to a stat agent here in Arizona. It was sent to Michigan. And that's where the subpoena was sent. It was sent by email. And I think by mail, I don't want to get that wrong, but the process of domesticating against a company that has its primary place of business out of state did not occur. None of the traps were run here for these subpoenas. And so we lawfully have the ability to resist. And if board staff or counsel disagreed with that, there's an enforcement procedure. And that enforcement procedure is certainly available to any administrative agency that believes that their subpoenas are not being responded to properly. But essentially what has happened here, Chair, is a burden shift. And we do have the right to assert any legal option and any legal alternative available to us. And it's not like we stonewalled. We did provide significant amount of information, including information that the board or the BA committee did find relevant to the question of Ms. Johnson's supervision. So this is not a case where we rested solely on that. We certainly have the right to assert our legal options and our legal objections.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. I'm sure other board members have questions, but I'll make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
There's a second by Dr. Stenhoff. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. All right, we're back in open session. It's 9:32 a.m. I see everybody's here. So any further questions for Mr. Carey at this time? Hearing none, let's get into the discussion phase. So as a matter of discussion, I think there is new information that has come before the board. And, you know, for better or worse, the board is a state entity that has some authority, some duties, some responsibilities to protect the people, protect the public in Arizona. So under that duty, that obligation, I believe that there is cause to refer the new information that the board has learned to agencies that likely have authority and jurisdiction over Centria. So I would be leaning toward forwarding the new information to the listed agency. So I think it's the Attorney General's Office, Access, Department of Health Services, Joint Commission. I'm missing one. Some Behavioral Health Center. So those would be the agencies entities that come to mind for that. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chairman Dinar. I absolutely agree. I think a part of our duty for public safety includes the monetary financial dealings of our licensees and people who are not licensed that are practicing. I think if public dollars are being spent by our agencies here in Arizona for treatment of unlicensed people, I think that should indeed be our concern. And I absolutely agree with you, Chairman, that these need to be passed on to the appropriate agencies for investigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more discussion or motion? Dr. Flint.
Thank you. I'm just considering not only the protection of the public, but also the fiduciary responsibility of public dollars being used in the investigatory process and how making appropriate referrals to agencies makes a lot of sense and is in line with the governor's commentary about wishing for, you know, that level of transparency, if you will, in making those referrals. So I concur with both of my colleagues that it seems like there is this might be an issue of if there's smoke, is there fire? That might not be our investigatory process to do, but it is someone's investigative process to do. And if they don't know because nobody told them, I would feel like I was failing in my job on this board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. And I think that also reminded me of, you know, the usual practice of the board is if there is any licensed professional, that licensed professional has an independent obligation to report any untoward matters to the appropriate licensing body. And to the extent that Centria has any employees or independent contractors who are licensees of this board, we would absolutely have jurisdiction over them. But the gray area comes into play where, you know, it's sort of almost like a word that Mr. Carey used in a different context, but gamesmanship in a sense where, you know, we have unlicensed professionals in a mid-tier who are potentially billing at a full-tier licensed professional's billing rate. So they're given that fact pattern and given that, you know, based on the evidence and the testimony we heard in the CBA and, you know, that's in the record, there seems to be this sort of seems to be a tip of the iceberg. And, you know, some agency like Access, for example, might have problems with it, given that, you know, they pay for Medicaid, Medicare services. So, yeah, again, all of that to say, you know, there should be a referral to the appropriate agencies for further investigation and evaluation. So maybe I'll make that a motion and then see who has a second.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
So to clarify, you are moving that the board adopts the recommendation from the Committee on Behavior Analysis.
Yes. Hearing no discussion, let's do a roll call on this, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So actually, let's take a 10-minute break and we'll come back to agenda item 10C. So we'll be back at, let's make it 9:50. It's 9:50 and we're back in open session. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So let's go to 10C, information identified in the investigative record for complaint number 24-12 concerning Kiara Bininger, BCBA, unlicensed in Arizona, be referred to the Behavior Analyst Certification Board for possible investigation. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide a summary of the matter?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this is the third and final recommendation from the committee that came out of the review of this particular complaint. The investigation revealed that Kiara Bininger may have information, may even be the source of sharing information relative to what is acceptable in Arizona concerning the use of unlicensed BCBAs to provide services and potentially bill for those services. So with the recognition that Ms. Bininger may be a fact witness for the board's investigation, we issued a subpoena to her. And to be clear, she has never before been licensed in Arizona as a behavior analyst. We understand that she may have held a license for a period of time in another jurisdiction. We understand that it's possible she is practicing in a jurisdiction that does not require licensure. We don't know all those facts because we didn't have the benefit or opportunity to pose those questions to her. For the reasons that you have, of which you are aware, the reasons that are cited in Mr. Carey's letter that is in your investigative report, Ms. Bininger did not respond to the subpoena, did not appear for the review of this matter. So consistent with the committee and the board's previous instances where it does not have any jurisdiction over a BCBA, over an individual, but understanding that the Behavior Analyst Certification Board does, the committee is recommending that the board forward this matter to the BACB for that organization to determine whether or not there is a possible violation of the ethical code. The report in front of you cites two possible violations, again, under the purview only of the BACB, but they are sections 1.02 of the code, which address behavior analysts following the law and the requirements of their professional community, which does include licensure boards, and also section 1.15, which is behavior analysts make appropriate efforts to respond for requests for information from and comply with deadlines of relevant individuals, which does include entities such as licensure boards. And with that, I can answer any questions specific to this recommendation. And again, maybe Mr. Carey would like to offer his input as well.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. Any questions for Ms. Pakkinen? Hearing none, let's... just to clarify, Mr. Carey represents Ms. Bininger. Is that correct?
No, I represent Centria, but given that this was a subpoena that was sent under Lang v. Superior Court, given whether she was a present or a former employee, the subpoena should have been sent to Centria. And so I think we do have standing to at least make comments, and you can do with those what you wish, but I would like the opportunity to reflect on what the board is proposing here.
Thank you for that clarification, because I just wanted to make sure who is whose client. Mr. Carey, if you want to make a statement, you're free to do so.
So let's start with the initial or the second. Let's go backwards. The second reason that the referral is being proposed is because of the failure to comply with the subpoena. This is, again, a case where Ms. Bininger or her employer could have ignored the subpoena. And instead, within the 5 days of receiving it, they did send in a response and indicated why she would not be present as an employee of Centria, and it was that, again, there was no jurisdiction. I think that we are going down, again, this is a new and very dangerous place where someone has exercised a lawful objection to a subpoena, and the board is proposing to report that person on the basis that they essentially exercised their legal rights. That is certainly not what the BACB contemplates. Certainly this is a case in which there was a non-perfected subpoena. So to be able to say that we're going to refer people for not complying with things that we don't have the ability to force them to comply with, and not only that, but they asserted their legal rights, I think the board is really going down a very dangerous path here. And I have trouble on that one seeing how that could not be perceived as punitive. It is essentially a consequence for asserting a legal right. What I can tell you is under Spivak, which is a case that allows clinicians to assert their Fifth Amendment right when they're facing a potential criminal charge, the Supreme Court of the United States, and then obviously the Arizona Supreme or Court of Appeals, has made it incredibly clear that one cannot be penalized for exercising their legal rights. So I think as to the allegation that we can find a violation because she did not consent to a board that has no jurisdiction over her, I think that's very dangerous. As for the other part of this, again, I think it's problematic that, again, this is the board is seeking to go forward and potentially cause licensing or credentialing trouble for people who have asserted their legal rights and for people who are outside of their jurisdiction. I think it's notable, and I know this only because I've been in this role, this position with lots of BAs, there is a specific provision in the BA code that indicates that there needs to be notice and a meet and confer with that clinician whenever possible before referring them to the BACB. And that certainly has not occurred here. And so the board or the committee would essentially, at least the BA members of the board, would essentially be sidestepping their own ethical duties by referring this individual without the necessary notice and opportunity to cure. And so I have some really deep-seated concerns here that the board is somehow simultaneously making a decision that is potentially unethical for its BAs and also illegal in relation to the violation that she failed to comply with a subpoena that does not have, that was not properly served, that was actually served in provided in violation of Lange v. Superior Court, over which there's no jurisdiction over someone who doesn't even have a licensee in the state. So I think there are so many levels of abstraction here. I am frankly at a loss as to why it would be a good idea, knowing everything now that I've provided in my letter, why the board would seek to refer on this one. And so I think the bottom line too is you have already multiple times now referred Centria, and I've obviously made my points about why I think that was inappropriate, but the case is already in front of the people that need to be investigating it. So this is essentially, I think we're beating a dead horse or we're piling on at this point, and we're doing it in a case where there's clearly not legal jurisdiction or properly served subpoenas. And so again, I would ask that discretion be the better part of valor here, make a decision not to refer this one to BACB and create additional obstacles for this non-licensee.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Any questions for Mr. Carey at this time? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Patty. So the person in question, Kira Benninger, is a behavior analyst?
That's my understanding.
But she's not licensed in the state of Arizona?
She's not licensed in the state of Arizona, that's correct.
But she's offering services as a behavior analyst in the state of Arizona?
I did not say that. I'm not here to comment upon Ms. Benninger. I'm here to comment upon Centria's position on the referral.
So the corporation hires unlicensed people to provide services in a state. And then when a licensing board attempts to gain clarification, the corporation says that because they're not incorporated in the state of Arizona, that their home territory is someplace else out of state, they do not have to provide that information. Is that right, Mr. Carey?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm not commenting about Centria's operations during this agendized item. What I'm commenting on is the fact that the board is proposing to refer an individual who has not a sufficient nexus to Arizona, who is served with an improper subpoena. Again, I think that the nature of your questions sort of illuminates the whole problem with this situation, is that this board does not have jurisdiction to investigate this. You've already made the referral. My concern remains that you're now, not you personally, Dr. Stewart, but the collective board is contemplating a referral of an individual for failing to comply with a illegitimate subpoena. The bottom line, too, is it is certainly not as clear cut as indicated, given that there are a number of exceptions to licensure, and those exceptions were documented very heavily in our papers to the board. And certainly those were not conveyed by board staff when the communications were made to the authorities that they referred out to. And so there, you know, it is not as clear cut. And certainly to the extent that in your question is inherent an idea that there's something improper happening, I certainly would object to that. But I go back to the fact that the agenda item for the board's consideration is merely whether to refer Ms. Bininger. And I do not think that the board has the authority or should exercise authority to do that, given that it has not met the BACB's requirement of meeting and conferring. It has not also demonstrated, I think, that it has jurisdiction over this case.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. I have no further questions, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any more questions for Mr. Carey? Hearing none, for the record, I just wanted to clarify, Ms. Bininger isn't here and she isn't represented by anybody who is here. All right, I'll take that silence as confirmation. So let's go into discussion at this time. So the question of referral is simply, you know, somebody else has the authority, has the jurisdiction to look into this. And it seems like Ms. Bininger, who is licensed by the BACB, would have jurisdiction over her. And, you know, for the record, I see sort of everyone seems to be talking around the bush, like no one's talking off the bush. They're talking about everything else. And that concerns me. I mean, I know that Centria has the right to defend itself, make all legitimate legal arguments and all of that. But it just seems like we are saying that, the board doesn't have jurisdiction over Ms. Bininger. The subpoena should have been issued to Centria. Oh, but you don't have jurisdiction over Centria, the subpoena should be perfected. Oh, for perfection, you need to go to Michigan or wherever else the company is. And in the meantime, the company is employing or contracting with unlicensed professionals who are doing business in Arizona and affecting the people in Arizona. I would say that is a substantial reason for asserting jurisdiction over not just these unlicensed professionals who are potentially engaging in title violations, but also over the company that employs them or contracts with them. But you know, that's just my personal views. I understand Centria's position on this. But given that the BACB has jurisdiction and authority over its licensed professionals, I think the appropriate action for this board to take would be to refer the matter to BACB. And, you know, referral just means that, hey, look into this. It doesn't sort of, you know, pre-formulate a certain legal conclusion. They can go through their processes, obtain more information, and maybe that will lead to nothing. You know, maybe that will lead to dismissal. But that's their call to make. That's not our call to make. I understand that as well. I wanted to start my discussion with that. Thank you. Any further discussion, Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I certainly agree that we're not passing judgment. We're simply making a referral for the appropriate agency to pass judgment, to investigate and pass judgment. So I take exception to Mr. Carey's saying that we're passing judgment. We're not doing that. We're not adjudicating whether someone is guilty or not guilty. But certainly the efforts to obtain information have been thwarted by the corporation. And so I'm certainly in favor of making the referral to the BCBA on Kara Benninger, especially as she's providing services, behavior analyst services in the state of Arizona. She's not licensed. If this is a pattern of that corporation, then, you know, I don't know who else to refer to other than the, you know, legitimate agencies, the Attorney General or the Corporation Commission or the individual payors of services. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion item? Dr. Stanhoff. You're muted, Dr. Stanhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Stewart as well. The fact is there's an ethical code that behavior analysts need to abide by. And if there is a law that indicates that you have to be licensed in a state in which you practice, you should follow that law. That steps outside the bounds of corporation. It's a obligation for your certification as a behavior analyst to act accordingly. And so given that, regardless of what Century is doing, the behavior analyst was acting plausibly outside of the ethical code. And so I think the relevant certifying body perhaps should to examine that and determine whether there was a violation. As both you and Dr. Stewart have indicated, we're not adjudicating this. We're leaving it up to the certifying board that oversees the behavior analyst action. And so I think that an examination of that would be proper in this circumstance.
Thank you, Dr. Stanhoff. Any more discussion or motion? Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with what has been stated by you, Dr. Stewart, and Dr. Steinhoff. I think we are not the licensing board for this individual because they're not licensed here. Then I think it's very, very appropriate to then proceed with whomever is certifying this individual because of our concerns. And so I just wanted to express my support for moving forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Discussion or motion? I'll make a motion to accept the recommendation of the committee and refer Ms. Benninger to BCBA.
Second.
I give the second to Dr. Seidman this time. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. So let's go to number 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation from the Committee on Behavior and Analysts to refer to the Behavior Analyst Certification Board information concerning Donna Cheeseman, BCBA. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please summarize the matter for the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Last month, the Committee on Behavior Analysts reviewed an application packet submitted by Melissa Payne. In doing so, the committee observed that there was documentation of many attempts on the part of the applicant dating all the way back to May of last year, May of 2023. So over 6 months of attempts on her part to try to elicit from a former supervisor, Donna Cheeseman, some documentation verifying her, at least some of her, a portion of her supervised experience, her training experience. And so in the beginning, Ms. Cheeseman did acknowledge the request and then for whatever reason did not respond to the many attempts that were made subsequently. So ultimately, the committee in these instances, there is a provision in the rule R426403, specifically subsection C1B, that does allow the committee to look at and consider the applicant's own submission of documentation if the documentation from the supervisor can, for whatever reason, cannot be obtained. So the committee forwarded a recommendation to the board to grant the license for Ms. Payne to find that she completed the training requirements, and the board did accept them. So Ms. Payne is licensed. However, in these instances, when a supervisor is determined by the committee to have failed to comply with the ethical code of the BACB to respond to requests for submission of this information to a licensure board, the committee recommends to the board, and the board has consistently referred this matter to the BACB for possible investigation and into whether the ethical code has indeed been violated. I do want to be clear that there was no evidence that Ms. Cheeseman was improperly providing any services unlicensed in Arizona. We understand her to be, at least according to the BACB's registry, she is a BCBA practicing in California. California doesn't require licensure there. So in summary, this is before the board simply to, and consistently with precedent, to share this information with the BACB for the BACB to determine, you know, whether it should look at this matter as a possible ethics code violation. And with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Pakkanen? Hearing none, I don't think the applicant is here or she's represented by anybody who is here, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then let's go straight into discussion. Any discussion items from the board members? Yes, Dr. Stewart, and then Dr. Flint.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Dunor. I certainly believe that we should take the committee's recommendation to pass this on to BCBA regarding a supervisor who refuses apparently to provide documentation to a potential applicant, a licensee. And I think it should be referred. Thank you.
Dr. Flint.
I agree with Dr. Stewart's assessment and for psychologists as well, the supervisory relationship might end in hours calculation, but you still have the duty to fill out appropriate paperwork to assist individuals in getting licensed in their appropriate states, boards. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that comes with multiple requests. And that's part of the gig that we sign up for as supervisors. And I just wanted to express my kind of discomfort that this seems to be maybe a bit of a question mark instead of an exclamation point. We have the responsibility to sign forms that allow the certification of hours so that boards and again, the public can be protected and assured that they have a high quality level of provider. And this stands in the way of us being able to do that in a way. And so I fully agree with the recommendation to forward it.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Discussion or motion? Dr. Stewart.
I move that we accept the committee's recommendation and forward this on to the BCBA regarding Donna Cheeseman.
Second.
There's a motion and a second by Dr. Medina. Any more discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Number 12, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding correspondence with Governor Katie Hobbs concerning healthcare licensing board's transparency and accountability. Ms. Pakkanen, will you please provide a summary of this matter?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So my memorandum explains that on February 15th, the Health Regulatory Boards received what appears to be, you know, identical communications from Governor Hobbs relative to some concerns that she had about the board's statutory responsibilities to protect the public, and in doing so, you know, providing transparency and also referring matters beyond the board's authority and jurisdiction to other appropriate entities, naming some specific criminal investigation entities in the process. And so this communication is quite consistent, I think, with, you know, much of the attention that has been focused on the boards. There's no shortage of news stories and so forth that have featured boards, including to a small degree this one. So in my mind, this communication was not a surprise. And I think what it presents to the board is really an opportunity, again, to, you know, sort of self-reflect and take a critical look at its own practices and its own policies. So given the timing of the issuance of the letter and the deadline with which to respond, a board meeting was not scheduled in the interim. And so I sought advice from Ms. Galvin in terms of, you know, might I be able to reach out to the board chair and collaborate with the chair on the initial response. However, I see the opportunity for ongoing communications updates. Obviously, you know, there's a deadline of July 1st for some specific deliverables, but I don't see that this is the final word, even at this early stage of this discovery process, of this information sharing process. So it may be that the board, wants to, I hope there's a robust discussion of Governor Hobbs' letter. I hope there's robust discussion of the response that Mr. Dinar ultimately signed off on. And it may be that I'm directed to provide, you know, something more short term to Governor Hobbs. But notwithstanding, you know, all of that, my intention at this time, and believe me, I've done a whole lot of brainstorming. My intention at this time is to bring back to the board at the April meeting, at the May meeting, proposals, some updates, some drafts that reflect what I believe would be, you know, an appropriate response, and, you know, provide assurance to the governor that we are meeting her directives. So with that, I think I'll pause and answer or address any questions that you have. Just by way of assurances, I had some concerns that maybe the board would feel possibly ill-equipped to sort of envision what might be a scoring rubric or, you know, some sort of standardized process for making what the governor described as decision-making concerning suspected abuse, neglect, or exploitation to law enforcement, and also how we are to consistently calculate, if you will, or arrive at appropriate actions given the findings of facts and conclusions of law that come out of an investigation. So at least for preliminary purposes, I wanted to assure this board that there is work being done. Coincidentally, I'm highly involved in some efforts around that. And so there are examples of rubrics and tools and instruments and guidance and, you know, all of those things being used in other states by other regulatory organizations. I have my favorites. I have other instances where I think they would, you know, not be as preferable as some others. And so I want to continue this work. Most of the board members probably aren't aware of this because it's been some time since we've discussed this issue, but a couple of years ago, this board formed a subcommittee of members to look at possible tools and instruments to arrive at consistent disciplinary decisions. As it happens, the only member of that subcommittee still with us is Mr. Diner. So we paused really the committee's work because of my appointment to this national group that was, you know, looking comprehensively at what was available, again, both to, you know, this profession as well as others, and then formulating, you know, some recommendations once that information had been gathered and analyzed. I think that where we find ourselves is that we really need to accelerate this process and we need to arrive at, you know, a decision relatively soon, certainly before July 1, about which direction we probably want to go, which tool, which instrument, maybe one of our own creation that we want to utilize. That being said, I do think that there's opportunity for this board to arrive at, you know, some possible policies or tools or instruments by July 1 and test them. And if we find them to be, you know, insufficient for whatever reason, I don't think this board is at all precluded from, you know, pivoting to a different strategy or modifying its policies or its strategies. But we do want to provide assurance, I'm sure, to Governor Hobbs, as well as to the public, that, you know, we are fulfilling the statutory mandate as a board. We are providing transparency and consistency in the process. So I welcome this set of challenges. I hope that the board sees it the same way. So with that, any questions for me at this stage of the process?
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. And I know when the letter came in, you worked very, very hard and diligently in getting a response out. So I thank you and, you know, everybody else who helped you in getting the response prepared. But I think, I mean, I suppose we have our marching orders in the sense that we have two deliverables that are coming up by the July 1st deadline. So my question for you, Ms. Pakkinen, is what do you need from us? Because, you know, I'm certainly willing to do what it takes to get from point A to point B, and I'm sure other board members are similarly willing. So, you know, this is, as I would put it, your party. I mean, whatever you need, we are here to help out. Let us know what you need.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your support and for, you know, the very swift response and for the high level of engagement that that you quickly provided around this issue, especially since we had not an unattainable deadline, but, you know, one that we certainly wanted to comply with, you know, in the immediate sense. So what I think I simply need is the time, the focus, to bring more concrete recommendations back to this board. I never, ever like to work close to deadlines. So that is why I am essentially promising, assuring this board that you will see this item again on April 5th. And I do intend at that time to have very specific proposed proposals for you to evaluate. It may be that what I present to you on April 5th, you find, not quite, you're not ready to approve it for whatever reason, and that's fine. Then I would want very specific direction for what to modify, how to modify it, so it can come back to you at the May meeting. To complicate matters to some degree, I have a poorly timed vacation in June that sort of, takes June out of the timeline. But what my goal is that what we achieve at the May meeting is finalization of the deliverables to Governor Hobbs. So I'm asking my staff specifically to, give me, the time to focus on what I need to focus on too, to be able to produce what I think would be proposals that don't require a lot of work and editing. I want to avoid a situation in April where you tell me, go back to the drawing board, everything that you submitted is, we couldn't possibly work with your drafts, with your recommendations, and with your proposals. So I really just need the time and the focus. Mm-hmm. I may also, want some input, some specific input. And Ms. Galvin, would it be still acceptable to continue working closely with the board chair if I do sort of reach a point where I feel like I need some direction?
That would be appropriate. That's what other executive directors have done, unless there's, a stated objection from a board member who would prefer a special meeting be called. I don't hear any.
I will tell you that in the examples that I provided, and maybe you were, surprised in the sense that this report, if you will, was so voluminous. But I will tell you that I want to categorically dismiss the state of California's Board of Psychology disciplinary guidelines and uniform standards. I think that falls short of constituting, anything that even looks like or amounts to a rubric. It is a whole lot of narrative, and I'm sure someone worked extremely hard on this. I don't necessarily find the document itself or the contents problematic. What I believe this to be is a very unwieldy document that would be extremely difficult for this board, frankly, to use as a tool. So that content begins on page 7. And if I remember correctly, it's at least a 30, maybe 35 page document. So it's very unwieldy. And the committee that I'm serving on for ASPPB, we essentially are, the committee has had this discussion that this is, very, very good content. Have no doubt that it, is very accurate. Perhaps the California board doesn't find it difficult to apply to their cases, but I don't see this as being consistent with the governor's directive. And I just think it's just very, I don't know that we could work with something of this magnitude. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I guess my follow-up question is, I think your initial letter to the governor made a very good observation about the existing tools that we have of an existing standardized process that we have. And we linked the flowchart and the rubric. So I guess my question is that what you're thinking of in terms of sort of maybe taking a second look at that and making amendments to it. You know, it's essentially like two or three pages, and it's very easy to follow, and it, you know, provides all the information in one spot. Is that something that you're thinking of, or is I'm maybe totally missing the point?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. So so we do have this resource, and it was one that I know was thoughtfully crafted and thoughtfully, you know, approved by a board, this board in the past. More recently, it's been refreshed with sort of a new look. And I think that, you know, in doing so, what we were hoping to achieve is that, you know, it is more, it's easier to use and it's easier to apply by the board. And let's give credit that the work was done by our most recent student intern who fortuitously had some design skills that she was, you know, willing and eager to apply at our request. So I think she did a very good job when we tasked her with that assignment. I think one of the things that we need to maybe consider that maybe that perhaps our tool falls a little bit short would be, I'm actually looking at the Oklahoma resource, which begins on page 44 of your PDF. I think that the introduction or the inclusion of the aggregating and mitigating factors piece is important. What I'm hearing a lot of my colleagues say is that, you know, this rubric task is a challenge because there are always sort of, you know, gray areas. So, you know, a board may make a decision based on, you know, specific facts and circumstances. And there may be a future case that looks very similar, that presents with similar facts and circumstances, but the board would do something different in case number two, because maybe there were mitigating factors that, you know, rendered the findings of fact and the conclusions of law as less, you know, harmful, less consequential. Or maybe there were aggregating factors involved that made it, you know, the outcome worse than case number one. So I think that needs to be factored in. So not only does Oklahoma take that approach, if I remember correctly, Oregon does as well. And I'm going to be honest and transparent. I really am a fan, if you will, of the work that the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy, that they did to arrive at their guidelines. I think that's the very last example in your report. Actually, I find a lot of value in what Virginia produced as well. But anyway, the FSBPT resource, I did not, as a former member of that organization staff, I did not staff the committee that wasn't the primary staff member who supports the work of that committee. However, I did work on the periphery of that committee as much of their work sort of intersected with mine. And so I have a high degree of familiarity, you know, with these, I guess they call them model board action guidelines. So, you know, I've seen the tool presented. I have seen it even presented in the context of to FSBPT members at a national meeting where different case scenarios were presented. The members of FSBPT then broke into small groups and applied the tool using the facts and circumstances of the scenario presented. So I guess I've had the benefit of seeing the tool in action, and I am a fan. I think it is, you know, something that we should take a close look at. So I can't give you an answer here now and today about specifically what direction that I'm going to recommend, but maybe the board just simply wants me to work with the work that we've already done. If the board wants me to go in sort of, you know, more of a different direction, a major shift, then we would be talking about some of these other tools like FSBPTs, for example. So I welcome input here now and today, so that when you see what I'm bringing to you in April, it's a reflection of what you feel comfortable approving.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Ms. Pakkanen, I have tremendous appreciation for your work ethic, and certainly I think that the month of June you are entitled to for vacation, just to get away from some of the trials and tribulations of this city, the board itself. I'm a fan of brevity. As a psychologist for myself, I can't speak for everyone, but we love to hear ourselves talk. And when we write voluminous reports, we do so with great narrative sometimes. I think if we can have a succinct rubric to use, I think the succinctness is key. I'm a big favor of not reinventing the wheel. If we already have something in place and we just need to make reference to that, I'm certainly more in favor of that than going and finding new tools and things. It does not surprise me that the State of California Board of Examiners has such a voluminous document that they consider useful for themselves. I won't comment on that any further. So anyway, those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Ms. Pakkanen.
Yeah, just some more thoughts, if I may, Mr. Chair. So I do want to call attention to the fact that the board will be expected to audit its compliance with their process. And so I don't know whether, I don't see that we are restricted necessarily to some sort of a self-audit sort of procedure. So that being said, there is a meeting that we've scheduled later this month with the governor's staff, you know, to try to get a little more guidance, you know, a little bit more direction. So, you know, that we all, by we, I mean the executive directors of the health regulatory boards, but what we want to achieve is, of course, you know, a shared vision to really understand the governor's vision. And so, going back to the audit, if a self-audit is, you know, part, if it's permissible, then, you know, we could be talking about a recommendation and formulating an audit committee, an audit subcommittee, where perhaps on an annual basis, you know, we sort of look at the application of the tool against the cases. If a self-audit isn't acceptable, I'm going to have to do a little bit more brainstorming, but I will, I'll continue to think about that and hope for an epiphany. Sometimes it comes at any rate. So the policy about decision-making concerning suspected abuse, neglect, or exploitation. I mean, I do think that I would feel comfortable representing that what this board does thoughtfully after adjudicating a case, even if it isn't always, you know, articulated maybe in the public portion of the meeting, that there is consideration being made to other, you know, referring matters to other relevant entities or agencies that do have jurisdiction, whether it's law enforcement or another state agency or so forth. So I think that policy, you know, would come together fairly, fairly easily. So I don't find that piece at all daunting. And I think that, you know, what board staff can do to ensure that that policy is being followed is with every case, we can ensure that the board chair script, you know, prompts for that kind of discussion at the end of any, you know, any investigative or disciplinary matter. I think that's one strategy that we could, you know, quite easily do is, you know, that's a reminder to this board, you know, to have that conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. And I think, I mean, in terms of the specific prompt from the governor's office, we are looking at sort of, you know, some of the more senior complainants or, you know, senior individuals who might have some complaints against psychologists and behavior analysts. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, minors who might be involved in cases that we investigate and adjudicate. So I think my personal view again is you're on the right track with that, but I also look to the psychologists and BA members on the board for more specific guidance as to what needs to happen in ensuring that we are, you know, we have a rubric or at least some sort of a standardized process.
Thank you. And if I may, I would be remiss if I fail to do a shout out to Dr. Medina. What I did as part of this exercise was to, you know, reach out to her. So what I needed was a psychologist to articulate more effectively than I possibly could. What we want the governor to know relative to the question that she posed: how do your board or board employees interact with complainants impacted by provider misconduct? And then the trauma-informed approach piece of that or element of that. This content is Dr. Medina's, and she supplied it, immediately and also very comprehensively. So it was shared with another professional member of this board, Dr. Davey, as, you know, representing, if you will, the other profession that we regulate. And he also, you know, found her language to be, very appropriate, very reflective, very comprehensive. And so I appreciated that she contributed that to this response.
Thank you, Dr. Medina, and thank you, Dr. Davey, in absentia.
You're welcome. I wasn't sure if that was meeting what we needed. I woke up early one morning questioning my submission.
No, I saw that it became part of the letter that we sent to the governor's office. So it was very much appreciated, your help, Dr. Medina. Thank you. So I guess my last question, Ms. Pakkanen, and since you hinted at it, you know, do we need a subcommittee? I mean, whatever needs to happen, right? So if we need a subcommittee, it's up to you as to, you know, what you recommend.
Certainly. So that will be, that's some foreshadowing, unless, you know, the governor's office gives us different direction that, you know, sort of a self-audit is not acceptable. You know, we'll have to get creative and figure out how we do that. So assuming that's acceptable, then, you know, that will be part of, you know, my formal recommendations that you will see soon. So the only thing that I'm really asking for from the board is there anyone who just sort of feels that, something has been overlooked, that any of the response, this first response, if you will, is not reflective or not indicative, you know, of what this board might have prepared. Had a meeting between, before the deadline, if you will. So in other words, did any of this take the wrong direction? I'd love to know that. Finally, is there any additional information that you want me to provide between now and July 1, more immediately? I left the door open for the possibility that, you know, here we are, we're meeting the March 1 deadline, but our board meets on March 11. So it may be that, you know, a subsequent follow-up response, you know, that augments or maybe says something different to this one may be forthcoming. So I'd really love to know that.
Dr. Seidman?
Well, Ms. Pakkanen, I found it quite comprehensive and all-inclusive. I thought it was a wonderful response. So thank you for all the work you've done.
My pleasure.
So just one thing actually occurred to me, Ms. Pakkanen. So a few months ago, before this governor's letter and all of that, The dental board prepared a rubric. It's like a four-page document and then a one-page document that's in the, I believe in all of the meeting folders for subsequent meetings. But we went through like a, you know, 4 or 5 month subcommittee process to come up with a rubric of mitigating factors and aggravating factors and how that affects, you know, disciplinary versus non-disciplinary and all of that. So perhaps as a point of information that might aid our understanding or our development of any amendments to our rubric, maybe that's something that you can take a look at, or, you know, if, to the extent it's helpful, obviously.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I will either submit a public records request to the dental board, or I will accost their executive director in the hallway and obtain a copy from him. I'm particularly interested in any resource that would be a reflection of that would have had review and be a reflection of our Office of the Attorney General. So, you know, it may be that I'm completely enamored of something, you know, in Virginia or FSBPT or Oklahoma and so forth. But if it's a non-starter, you know, in Arizona for, you know, whatever legal reason, then I certainly don't want that to be introduced to any document that this board attempts to use.
Very good. And thank you again, Ms. Pakkanen, for working on this. I know it's, you know, it's I think a good exercise even without the governor's letter. I think it's a good exercise for any board to periodically sort of review their rubrics and decision-making guidelines. So I welcome, you know, that this was prompted by the governor's office. Any more discussion on this item? Hearing none, let's go. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. Ms. Pakkanen, do you have everything you need right now from us, from the board?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stewart, I do. I appreciate the support. You know, I appreciate what I'm hearing is that, you know, I'm guiding the board or steering the board in the right direction. You should all reserve the right to, you know, look very critically at what I bring to you next month and, you know, give me entirely different, you know, feedback, of course, and I'll be prepared either way.
Okay. Thank you. I have no further comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Pakkanen, any time between now and the next meeting, if you need anything from me, just let me know. So number 13 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the following applications for EPPP and or licensure. I think we'll take them one at a time. So 13A is Heather. I apologize for misspelling. Koutsoujanis Sai-D, and this is a new application for exam and licensure application. And Dr. Flint, since you're the lead, would you please provide a summary to the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Koutsoujanis, again, I'm hoping I'm close, received her doctorate of psychology from Argosy University in 2010. Her application has been in front of this board previously with approvals to sit for the EPPP in 2015, a re-app to sit again in 16, and in 17, the extension to that application expired. So the application at that point was administratively closed. The reapplication occurred with two references, a self-query involved with no issues on those. And really, it's just coming in front of the board because we had a recusal on the committee. But to my knowledge, there was no other concerns with moving forward with an approval to sit for EPPP and then licensure upon attaining that proper pass rate.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Any questions for Dr. Flint? Hearing none, discussion or motion? Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. This applicant has attempted to pass the EPPP twice. And I'm wondering, should there be a training plan from her developed, or is that too is that premature?
Mr. Chair, board members, this is Kathy. The requirement for a study plan does not go into effect until the person has taken the ECCC three times.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Folks, for that clarification. Any further questions or discussion or motion?
I have a motion.
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I move that we approve the applicants for ECCC and licensure.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. So 13B is Boikanvo Thlong. Again, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, for licensure by waiver application. And Dr. Flint, you're again the lead on this application, so please provide us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This applicant came before the ART Committee after submitting an initial application for supervised temporary license, passing ECCC, and then the applicant changed the application to a waiver application. And this was approved by Ms. Pakkinen, the board's executive director. There was a little bit of a glitch in the online system, and some questions were not answered, and the board staff followed up with those. They were provided to the applicant in an incomplete notice, and then the email response was in the packet provided to us. We were on the application review committee meeting in the beginning of March, and Dr. Caterino had to recuse, but wanted to note for the record that Dr. Thlong listed her as an advisor on this application, and she did not fulfill that role for this applicant. And due to lack of quorum, we brought it to the board. Now, there are several potential issues that I just want to quickly outline. There were two consecutive internships and then two consecutive postdocs that happened, and we have documentation from both of those. The self-query, there was an answer to the self-query about a denial of licensure that Dr. Thlong was questioned about and admitted that should have said yes. That particular issue with license came before the Arizona BBHE, and since has been completely remediated, and she was actually given a license in 2009, but because she had been declined, that appropriate attestation would have been the best course of action. We have a couple of potential issues and potential violation of law in that some of the answers provided regarding the internship and supervision in particular don't match up with the requirements, apparently. One of those being that there was not a second licensed psychologist on staff, which is an ARS 32-2071-F2. The applicant was questioned and confirmed that that was in fact the case. In addition, there was an answer no to the question, did the training program include interaction with other psychology trainees? There were apparently not other trainees in that. The next point of conversation or clarification was that the written training plan required by the California board for one of her placements was supervised, or the delegated supervisor was actually an LMFT and not a licensed psychologist. And we need to look at those hours to see if they're applicable and can be counted, being that those two requirements were apparently not met. There was another issue that I actually just realized this morning, so I apologize that it didn't make it into the memo. In the two postdoc positions, according to the documentation, it appears that one postdoc that was listed at 40 hours a week, which is Shasta, and one postdoc at Dunamis, which was listed as 32 hours a week, were apparently happening at the same time in June, July, and August. And there is a law or a code that says that you can't count over 40 hours per week. So I am concerned about the calculations for June, July, and August of 2022. So in light of us being unable to kind of process some of these things in the art committee due to that recusal, we bring it forward to the board for discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Any questions for Dr. Flint? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Flint, thanks for that presentation. So the ARC has found that there are questions as to whether this applicant meets requirements for licensing. Is that correct?
We couldn't discuss or vote on it in the ARC because of the recusal, okay. But these were issues noted upon review of the application.
And so there's no recommendation by ARC because of the lack of, okay.
Correct, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. I have no further questions, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Dr. Seidman.
And Dr. Flynn, just for clarity, this applicant is applying for licensure by waiver. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So my question would be for, and this is for the entire board, because we are sort of like standing in the shoes of the ARC committee, you know, whether to approve the licensure by waiver or not. What needs to happen or what sort of information or clarification do we need from the applicant? I think based on the concerns identified, I think it's appropriate to ask for additional information before we are in a position to approve or deny or act on the application. Ms. Pakkanen.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And you very nicely teed up what I think the board needs, you know, some guidance around, which is anytime there are deficiencies identified in an application, deficiencies that, you know, where additional information might, you know, better inform the board relative to does this person meet the qualifications for licensure, in those instances, you issue the FAIR letter. So the first additional request for information request, sorry. So I do believe that, you know, the board has that option before it. What I think that whether this board wants to acknowledge this now or not, I mean, that's up to the board. The question then becomes, are there deficiencies that a FAIR would address? In other words, would additional information allay this concern, you know, provide enough information for the board to make a determination, augment the application relative to what's missing? The challenge is always going to be when the deficiency relates to something that an applicant may not have the opportunity to cure. So it's a deficiency specific to an internship. An internship, there's no real do-over opportunity. I'm not discouraging this board at all from issuing a FAIR, but the FAIR is a due process opportunity for an applicant to bring forward any new information that might, you know, cure those deficiencies. Did that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, and for example, I mean, like the 72 hours, the 40 hours and 32 hours that are overlapping, I mean, there might be an explanation for that, which the FAIR might give us that information. Or it could be that, okay, you know, there was an overlap, so we have to only count 40 hours. And then does that meet the 1500 hours? Or, you know, that's the question, right? So maybe that's like the first step. But again, like, correct me if I'm wrong, if there is something that, you know, we think that any additional information wouldn't give us any new knowledge about. So, I mean, if it's impossible to comply with a particular statute, given what we know, that may be something that isn't appropriate to ask about in a request for more information. Dr. Medina and then Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment was that it appears to me that the internship does not meet our requirements. So regardless of whether the clarification on the postdoc comes through or not,
to our satisfaction, you still have that fact from the information that we have. And at this point, I don't see that getting the fare would move us in one direction or the other. I mean, it wouldn't still satisfy the internship requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
If I may, I'll defer to Kathy, who may have information regarding whether this applicant can be licensed at all. And then I'll speak, if that's okay with the chair.
Mr. Chair, board members, I just wanted to note that Dr. Talong is on in the meeting if you had any questions for her.
Thank you, Ms. Folks. Back to you, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Kathy. I agree with Dr. Medina. If we know that the internship did not meet the specificity of the statutes, then talking about hours and things like that is moot. She still cannot be licensed, is my understanding. Is that correct, Ms. Packin?
Mr. Chair, yes, Dr. Stewart. It would I think, I don't want to put words in Ms. Galvin's mouth, but inappropriate for the board to inconsistently apply to any applicant a determination for with specific to an internship that did not meet all the required elements in Arizona law. I've heard this board, you know, quite consistently in the past, identify internship deficiencies, and you know that was in every case a basis upon which to not approve the application. I don't want to get too ahead of too far down the road with this discussion, but you know this board is going to. The board is going to have to take action on this application if you decide that, you know, a fair is not going to provide the clarity that, you know, might enable, you know, a different review or a different outcome of the application. So in other words, if a fair isn't issued, you know, the board needs to consider what options it must take at this point, denial, which we know to be reportable, whether a withdrawal of the application might be appropriate. So that's to me the next step. But again, the applicant is here, so you may have questions for her that may inform in this consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Packinen. Ms. Galvin, is it appropriate to ask the applicant to make a statement if they so wish?
You may.
Thank you. Ms. Long, if you are here, can you please unmute yourself and enable your video, and then you may wish to make a statement.
Thank you for having me. I want to take the opportunity to thank you for actually putting my case on the table and looking at it, because I did go to California Southern University, and I am in the process of licensing with the Board of California. And I have been in communications with the Board of Arizona as to my application not meeting qualifications, especially the pre-doctoral internship. The pre-doctoral internship in my school was pretty rigorous, because we were actually meeting with other doctoral students on a weekly basis. With a clinical supervisor that is licensed. It's just that it was from the school perspective, but on the ground in the agency that I worked for, I also had a clinical supervisor. So I don't know if that is not considered two psychologists on board, because I did get supervision from both supervisors, and they were licensed as clinical psychologists throughout my whole pre-doctoral internship. And pertaining to the question of two internships running concurrently, yes, I did. But with the other agency dynamics. I was only there for like a minimum of 4 hours a week while I was in the Shasta County for full time. So I was literally getting supervision both times for both agencies for a reason of specialization, because I wanted to specialize in an area that the other agency didn't provide, which is conservatorship. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Strong, and thank you for being here. And please correct me if I'm mispronouncing your name.
Oh, you were saying it perfectly.
Thank you. Dr. Medina and then Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question would be perhaps, I can ask Dr. Thong and then seek clarification from our staff. So thank you for being here, Dr. Thong. So if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that the second internship supervisor would have been the staff from the university who was overseeing your internship placement?
Yeah, for my pre-doctoral.
Okay. Did that supervisor person from the university have access to the full access to your records at the agency and carried sort of the
no
clinical responsibility?
The answer is no. It was a school program. So I was pointing to the fact that I did have a clinical supervisor on a weekly basis on top of the clinical supervision that I was receiving in the agency.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. And it is my understanding, I don't know if this would be made perhaps for Kathy or Ms. Bakkanen, it's my understanding that the intern would need to have two supervisors at the placement of internship.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Dr. Seidman and then Dr. Flint. I'm sorry, Dr. Thong, if Dr. Thong wants to address that.
Oh, I was just asking, what is the remediation program then in Arizona if somebody doesn't meet the qualifications per the internship requirement?
Well, I don't know that that's...
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dr. Tlong, there is a subsection in 32-2071 Arizona Revised Statutes that it's subsection L, and it talks about respecialization. It allows for the board to accept a respecialization, which includes an internship that meets the requirements, and then you can come back and reapply at that point. The committee, the application review committee also has recommended to other applicants historically, when this comes up, that if they get licensed in another state after a year, they can license here by universal recognition if they have established residence in Arizona. So that's another option in the future. So both of those, and Jean may know something else to convey.
I think you covered it. If she also were to become an APAP or part of the National Registry, that's another way to come in.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't want to cut in front of the line in front of Dr. Medina, but I do want to make a somewhat of a correction to what Ms. Folks was describing, if that's okay.
Sure.
So rather than bouncing, you know, back and forth a bit. So what I heard Ms. Folks say is that the board has recommended to applicants, you know, to consider the respecialization opportunity. It really isn't a recommendation. What the committee, ARC, and the board have done historically is to invite applicants to look at that statute and evaluate for themselves whether or not that, you know, may be a pathway that they wish to pursue. Also, I don't I think it's a little, we don't want to suggest that the board recommends that you apply for universal recognition. But that's been identified as, you know, a possible consideration for an applicant to make. Again, you know, that's, it's not a recommendation, but, you know, that just raise awareness that this may or may not be something that an applicant decides to pursue at some point in the future. So not a recommendation, just, you know, identifying, you know, as a courtesy, what is already, you know, available on the board's website relative to application options. But, you know, I think in terms of a remediation program, when there's a deficiency, you know, in the professional experience realm, we perhaps that exists in California, but I don't know that we have a statute in Arizona that outlines or gives the board authority to develop that, you know, what you're describing as a remediation program. I don't recognize that in the statutes, and Ms. Galvin seems to concur. Thank you. I'm sorry, Dr. Medina.
No, you're fine. I don't have anything. I think it just stayed out from my previous comment.
All right. Previously, I saw Dr. Seidman and Dr. Flynn's hands up, so I'm giving you an opportunity now.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Again, this is probably going to be redundant, but for clarity, Dr. Thong, your faculty member was either a director of clinical training or perhaps a classroom instructor and wasn't your direct clinical supervisor for that second person who has 100% responsibility for the work that you do along with your primary supervisor. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Flynn, did you have something?
It has been answered in the interim. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay,
thank you. All right, so I think the options, Dr. Slong, are you either, looks like you can withdraw the application and then look at the statutes and determine, you know, which course of action is the best suited for your particular situation and then perhaps come back. But then the other option would be for the board to deny this application because I'm sure you have had a wonderful experience with the internship and postdoc, but, you know, it just doesn't comply with our statutory requirement. So, I mean, that's the other option is to for the board to deny this application. But the first option still remains an option that would prevent the board from then denying the application if the application is withdrawn. So it's really up to you at this point, you know, what
I will take the first choice.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Thong. Ms. Galvin.
Yes, I would prefer a motion from the board that would allow her to withdraw her application.
Okay.
Typically, we give her the applicant 10 business days to withdraw. And if it doesn't occur within that time, then the application is denied.
All right. So thank you, Ms. Galvin. Dr. Medina.
Yes, I move to allow Dr. Huang to withdraw her application within 10 days. And if that is not completed, then at that point, we deny the application.
Second.
Second by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. Dr. Thong, thank you again for being here. And, you know, this is, we try to comply with our statute. So good luck to you. And we look forward to you coming back with a new application at some point in the future.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to number 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the proposed consent agreement for voluntary surrender signed by Catherine Tarr, CID, in case number 24-22, or other administrative remedies available to the board. Ms. Michelson, will you please provide an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My overview will be high level, so this will be fairly brief. The board may recall that it reviewed this case at its meeting last month in February. The complaint contained allegations related to impairment. When this case was reviewed by the CSC back in January, the committee made a recommendation to the board that Dr. Tarr be required to undergo a psychological evaluation with a fitness for duty and substance use components. The board last month unanimously voted to accept the CSC's recommendation and at that time offered Dr. Tarr the opportunity to enter into an interim consent agreement for an evaluation and practice restriction of a license suspension. Ultimately, Dr. Tarr declined the proposed interim consent agreement. She notified staff subsequently that she had elected to surrender her Arizona license. Based on that indication, a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of psychologist license was sent to Dr. Tarr for her consideration. The signed agreement was received late last week, which is included in the board's packet. This consent agreement is before the board for consideration today and approval as a final disposition of this case. Just as a reminder, if it is approved, it's a disciplinary action that would be reported to the National Practitioners Data Bank. And I do want to note that the California Psychology Board, where she also holds a license, would receive notification of this action filed with the data bank. Just as an aside, the complainant MA is present. However, she did notify me recently that she did not wish to address the board today. Dr. Tarr did not indicate one way or another she would be attending. So I do not see her present, but Mr. Chair, I'd request that you do double check before the board deliberates on the proposed consent agreement. So that's all that I have, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Any questions for Ms. Michelson? Dr. Seidman.
Thank you. Ms. Michelson, does Dr. Tarr know that this is a disciplinary action that will be reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank?
Yes, she does. Not only did I indicate that in my email correspondence to her, which is in your file, the consent agreement that she signed, I believe on its page 5 or 6, indicates that this is a disciplinary action that will be reported to the data bank.
Thank you so much.
Any questions for Ms. Michelson? Hearing none, I'll just acknowledge that MA, the complainant, is here. Thank you for being here. I know you don't wish to make a statement. Is Dr. Tarr here? If so, would you please unmute yourself? And if you want to make a statement, you may do so at this time. Hearing none, and I don't see in the list of participants anybody, but that doesn't mean, because there are some sort of without names on, like phone numbers. So I'll take this as confirmation that Dr. Tarr is not present today. So we'll go into discussion. Any discussion or motion? So as a matter of discussion, I'll just say, I mean, this is pretty fresh in all of our minds, I think. You know, we offered a evaluation as a step toward figuring out what's happening. And the licensee chose to voluntarily surrender, and therefore staff worked on reaching agreement on the voluntary surrender of license, which I know it's not a small thing. I mean, you know, surrendering a license is a big thing, and it's you know, to the extent that it is appropriate given what we know, I think we should accept the voluntary surrender of license. Dr. Stewart.
I was just going to make that as a motion, or I'll second your motion if that was a motion.
All right. Well, I'll take your motion, Dr. Stewart, and I'll second it.
Okay. I recommend the board accept the surrender of license and then as a disciplinary action, report this to the National Practitioners Data Bank.
I'll second. Any further discussion? All in favor? No, actually, roll call.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Let's go back to item number 9. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation and a bunch of bill numbers, and an update concerning the proposed executive budget for financial year 2025. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the board will be relieved to hear that this summary is going to be relatively brief. A lot of bills have crossed over, but have not been heard in the committee of introduction. And so there are very few, you know, comments to make. First of all, I'll start with there are no updates relative to the possibility that the board's fund, the funds in the board's fund will be accessed and used to address the current fiscal year's substantial deficit. So the proposal, of course, that we, you know, saw in the executive budget issued in January, that just remains a proposal at this time. Undoubtedly, there are some conversations that are happening, you know, as the legislature and the governor's office move into a negotiations phase. So, you know, we are not privy to any of those conversations or those insights. And I really haven't heard anything, you know, from the legislature in terms of, you know, whether this is a piece of the proposed budget that, you know, they are willing to consider. So that is very much a mystery, I think, to all of us at this time. So no update there. I did early this morning, and I don't necessarily expect anyone to have noticed, but I did surreptitiously sneak an update report to you, a tracking report update, into the folder. What I want to focus my remarks to are a couple of concerns. And these relate to the bills that we are most closely tracking because of their impact to this board, direct impact. So House Bill 2050, of course, the board's, the bill that the board has requested. You heard me last say that the Chamber of Introduction, the House of Representatives, approved this bill with the requisite support for it to be assigned in the Senate for review, or so we thought. What is creating some unease, certainly on my part and also on the bill's sponsor's part, Representative Bliss, is that it has not been assigned to a first reading yet. And so we're trying to get clarity from the Senate president, who makes that decision relative to, you know, which bills get first read and assigned. This is the last week for any bill that passed the House to be first read and assigned. And so, you know, this is the week that it's, you know, do or die, I guess, for this bill. So I wish that I knew more about, you know, what is happening, what may not be happening relative to this bill, but we're running out of time to see this bill assigned in the Senate. And so if it isn't assigned, then, you know, it falls to the same fate that it experienced last year. And, you know, those provisions don't get changed in the statute. And so we don't get to move forward with any of those licensure reforms, you know, just sort of removing some of those hurdles to licensure that, that the board has been thoughtfully identified. So I'll keep the board informed about that matter. The other issue that developed was House Bill 2068. This is the bill that would establish the independent board for behavior analysts. I think that there was sort of a universal assumption, I certainly am guilty of this, that the bill would be assigned to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, where it's anticipated by everyone to to be supported by that committee and receive a due pass recommendation. Not necessarily a unanimous vote in support, but with a majority of committee members likely to support the bill and move it forward to the full Senate. What happened instead is it was not assigned to Health and Human Services. It was double assigned to two committees who, you know, may have, are expected to, you know, apply more scrutiny to this bill. So when I alerted the lobbyists to what I had observed, which was a different assignment than I think we were all expecting, I was advised that, you know, they're going to work on a plan. I don't know what that plan amounts to or consists of. So, you know, where that is concerned, I just feel a sense of, you know, the board will stay in its lane and just sort of see, you know, what the profession, what the association and what their lobbyists, what they elect to do, you know, given this this situation. Any questions about those two bills before I just touch on a couple more? Okay, then I think that maybe the only other one that I really want to touch on today is really just House Bill 2243. So this is the fingerprint clearance card fix bill, as I'm referring to it, just so, you know, kind of makes sense to all of us. So this bill is moving quite effectively past the House unanimously, a couple of absent votes, I guess, but more importantly, the committee that it's been assigned to in the Senate, in the second chamber, it also passed unanimously. So this bill is moving. It's one of the front runners relative to all bills. It does have the emergency provision. So assuming that it sees a floor vote relatively soon, if not this week, then early next week, because it still has to clear the Rules Committee. But it may be that Governor Hobbs sees this bill in the next 10, 14 days. So assuming it is signed, the emergency provision will be enacted. However, that doesn't mean that we are authorized as an agency, as a board, immediately to begin accepting a fingerprint card, the evidence that a fingerprint card has been applied for. What this means is that the Department of Public Safety can go to the Federal Bureau of Investigation with what they have all agreed is acceptable language to the FBI to approve all of these agencies to begin collecting that information. So even with the emergency clause, we still have to wait, continue to wait for FBI approval. And it's anybody's guess, you know, how quickly that happens. So board staff, we are closely tracking this. We've had some conversations around, you know, what we need to do to pivot quickly to implement this, what that might look like. These conversations are somewhat preliminary, but I want to assure this board that, you know, once we have the green light that we've been waiting more than 2 years for, I think we are positioned to move relatively quickly to implement this requirement. Are there any questions about that? So I will stop there because I think that we just sort of have to see how the remainder of the bills really fare in the in the crossover environment that they're in now. We are getting a fair number of questions from the governor's staff relative to some of these bills and the impact they may have on the board. So I'm responding to those inquiries, you know, as promptly and as thoroughly as I can. You know, I don't have any insights into, you know, which bills, what their fate may be, if and when, you know, they reach Governor Hobbs. But I think by the April meeting, a lot of this picture will be more clear.
Thank you, Ms. Paikkanen, and I commend you for all of your work on this front. You know, I know it sort of comes out of the blue. These are fast-moving items, so I thank you and staff for your hard work and diligence on keeping updates on, you know, keeping tabs on all of this. Anything more on item number 9?
Unless there's any other questions, that's, I think, all I have to offer at this time.
Okay. Number 15, new agenda items for future meetings. Do any board members wish to put any items on a future meeting? Hearing none, it is 11:30 a.m. and I'll exercise my privilege in adjourning today's meeting. Thank you, everybody, once again for all of your hard work and for, you know, taking care to go through all of these complaints. I really appreciate all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.